Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. Can you hear me back there? I'm talking to people early. I realized that there was a lot of Dharma activity in our community this weekend. There was a half day of mindfulness yesterday and then last night. And I was at the one last night. We had a potluck. I think about 30 or 40 members of the community there, and it was nice to break bread with those of you who were there. And then today there's been a meeting of people in the intensive this morning, and this afternoon a Sangha care committee. So I salute those of you who are still here. And actually, since I think I was here 3 weeks ago, since I was here last time, we had a three-day retreat here in the Franciscan Center in Tampa. And we had the subject matter for the retreat was a wonderful Zen master by the name of Bankei. Very interesting teachings on the unborn Buddha mind and how to realize it and live it. So for those who are interested, I believe they are posted now on the website, Zen Master Bankei. So before we get back into our teachings, we always begin with if anyone has any questions, new or old. I mean, not new or old questions, but new or old, whether you're new today, first time, or you've been coming a long time. Any questions that anyone has about the meditation practices, the practices of mindfulness, and equally as important about how to live the teachings and bring them into all aspects of our daily life, especially those aspects that are problematic or conflictual or difficult, because Dharma has a lot to be, the Buddha Dharma has a lot to say about how to transform these difficult situations. So does anybody have any questions? Yes.
Colin.
You're what?
My name's Colin.
Colin.
Right.
Yes, Colin.
What are you supposed to do when you're walking?
What are you supposed to do? Nobody told you. Well, thank you for following along. traditionally, well, do you know about sitting mindfulness meditation? The sitting.
I read 3 pages this evening before I came.
Okay. But you heard I gave a little talk introduction when we were sitting, so that gives you a sense of what of what the sitting is. So we're practicing mindfulness, learning to be just present in a very direct way to what is happening, right? Without a lot of conceptualization, with not being lost in past and future, learning how just to be alive and present. So when we sit with awareness of the body and use the breath as a way to anchor us, right? To give our concentration a place to hold to so we don't just wander off following every thought that comes along. And actually, the walking is the same way. I mean, what we're doing is learning how to cultivate mindfulness in all aspects of our life, and obviously we spend a lot of time moving around. So learning to move in mindfulness is important. So when we're walking in mindfulness, like we're doing today, you're walking with the awareness in your body, right? So you're very present to your body as it moves, and you're paying a special attention, again, to help ground you to the contact of your feet, heel to toe, as it touches the floor. So we're walking in mindfulness, special focus on the foot touching the floor, sort of knowing where every footstep where we are. And again, doing our best to stay present, to be mindful, right? And the same like earlier instructions, the mind continually will put up thought. That is its nature. That is not the problem. The problem, of course, is that we attach to, we follow, right? We get involved in. That's the problem, right? So it's the same instruction. So if thoughts arise, and if you're focused on your body and you're walking, the thoughts just come and go. But if you find that you get you follow them, you get interested in them, or you try to push them away or anything, as soon as you become aware that you're doing any kind of manipulation like that, just relax. let go, come back, remember what? Oh, I'm walking. That's what I'm doing. Right? So we need to use our minds instead of always defeating us, or we need to use our minds to support us. And so there's nothing wrong with saying to yourself, oh, I'm supposed to be walking in awareness, not thinking about this, not thinking about that, right? And that takes 10 seconds, 5 seconds, just to give yourself a little reminder, right? So there's nothing wrong with that, right? And then just let go and come back to walking. And again, if when you're walking, you're mindful of where you're walking, you're in your body, if thoughts are coming and going, that's not a problem, right? Don't be concerned about that, right? Thoughts by themselves are no problem. The same way, if we're living life, as most of us do, or if you're sitting somewhere and you want to practice sitting meditation, well, the fact that there are sounds, right? Like we might sit here and there are sounds of the air conditioning system going on and off, or there may be sounds of cars in the street, or there may be somebody talking outside, right? In the same way, when those sounds, different types arise, we don't have to grab onto them, right? Oh, we don't have to start thinking about them in a positive way, or we don't have to go, I wish those people had shut up, they're ruining my meditation. You know what I mean? We don't have to do any of that. We can just let the sounds arise and disappear. A bird song, or whatever. So in the same way, whatever sights appear to the eyes, whatever sounds appear to the ears, whatever sensations arise in the body, whatever thoughts arise in the mind, the real instruction is don't interfere with them, but also don't attach, don't grab on, don't follow. Because when you follow them, that's when you get led away. Away from what? The now, which is your life. Right? So, but again, you don't want to get into a battle with thoughts. You don't want to, struggle. Because when you get into a battle with your thoughts and you struggle, you only make them more intense. Actually, in the teachings from Zen Master Bunke that we did at retreat, and if you listen to them, you'll hear, he has a great kind of metaphor or simile where he says, using thought to get rid of thought. He said it's like if you have a blood stain, right? Some piece of garment is stained with blood, and anybody knows blood is not an easy stain to get out. He said it is like trying to wash away the blood stain with more blood. Right? Obviously, that would not get rid of the stain. And the same way, he says, trying to get rid of thought by pushing it away with more thought is also not the way. Right? Better just let it go. Do not be disturbed. At this point, many of us are disturbed by our thoughts. We're disturbed because we don't think we should have thoughts, or we think we have too many thoughts, or else we don't like the content of the thoughts that are arising. So therefore, we make a big deal about them and get involved in them and struggle with them, either trying to avoid them or trying to get rid of them and things like that. Much better in this tradition is just to see thought is just what? Thought is just thought. Just a little word that passes through the mind, right? That has a very short duration. It's highly irregular and erratic in its arising, and left to its own devices, will pass away quite quickly. So why get bothered by them? Right? Many of us spend our life being bothered by things that are only of short term, right? Including people, situations. We get hot and bothered. Right, and yet these situations, these experiences are usually quite short-lived. So why let them disturb our equanimity? So that's what walking meditation is about.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
Kirk.
Yes, Kirk.
The Sangha chant, I'm not really familiar with it. The next time I come here, I'd like to be familiar with it. How does that go?
What?
When you guys chanted.
Oh, when everybody chanted together. Yeah, that's kind of a traditional chant. It simply says homage to Shakyamuni Buddha in Sanskrit. That's really what's being said. And again, Shakyamuni Buddha is the founder of this lineage. So it's just sort of acknowledging that we are practicing in this Buddhist tradition that goes back 2,500 years. So that's that chant. Shakyamunaye, that's the Buddha. Any other questions? Yes, Salima.
I took refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha.
You said you've taken or you take? I missed it.
Yes, I practice taking refuge.
Okay.
I also go for refuge within myself, that island within myself, after studying Thich Nhat Hanh's book on happiness. And I also learned the gatha, which brings me a lot of peace.
Can you say the gatha for those who don't know it?
Breathing in, I go to that island, I go within myself. There are trees in that island. There are cool streams of water. There are birds, sunshine, and fresh air. Breathing out, I relax. And so what I wanted to know was, does this practice, going within myself, finding that I have a place of calm and peace, does it correlate to the three jewels, or is it a separate practice, or does it pertain to the Buddha? I know Thich Nhat Hanh said that we all know the Buddha seed, the seed of the Buddha in us. So I just want to know if it has anything to do with the three jewels, or it's a separate practice.
So the question is, so I'm doing this for the microphone, for the recording. I forgot to do it earlier. But the question is, Salima was saying she does a practice from Thich Nhat Hanh's practicing with these gathas about developing, returning to one's island in oneself, and there's a little description of the naturalness of, and the beauty of this inward place. And Salima says, how does this relate to the three jewels? How does this relate to with the Buddha Dharma Sangha? How does this relate to the Buddha seed within? It's funny. I remember once when I was in India in the 70s, studying and practicing in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. I had come from Zen. Zen, very simple. It's like minimalist, right? I then went to practice in Tibetan Buddhist tradition, which is like going to Rococo, Baroque. I mean, it was like the other extreme, you know. And one of the things that in Tibetan Buddhism, if you're familiar with it, is lots of deities. You know, just all kinds of, there's this one and that. There are all kinds of deities and Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You know, just and of course, coming from Zen, it was like, you know, what is all this? And And I remember talking to this one of my teachers and said, you know, I said, you know, I mean, these are different symbols, different formulas, but aren't they all in essence the same? And he said, of course. He said, look at me. He said, if I'm in a house and I put on a mask and a costume, right, of one deity, and I'm in the living room, right, and you come in and and you say hello to this deity. Then I quickly go out and I change my costume and I go into another room, and then you come into that room and, I look totally different. And he kept going through this, and he said, but it's all me, isn't it? And basically what he was saying is, right, many forms, right, but in essence, all the same. So what you find in the Buddha's teaching, many different types of teachings, right, that serve varied purposes, but all really serve one purpose, right, which is to help us awake. In that sense, again, all practices serve the same purpose. Now, to begin to use gathas and kind of words and images and symbols, like in that one, an island in oneself. I mean, if I said to you objectively, Salima, are there trees growing inside your body? Right? And you would say, no, it's a kind of a metaphor, it's an image. Right, that helps me cultivate not only a sense of inwardness, but a sense of peace and tranquility, right? Right. So, the images serve a purpose, right? To bring you to a deeper place within yourself, a calmer place, a more stable place, a more grounded place, right? In Buddhism we say the raft is not the shore. The image, of course, is when you're crossing a river, you need a raft. You need some kind of vehicle, right, to get you from one side to the other side. But when you get to the other side, you don't have to take the raft and carry it with you, do you? You've made use of it. It's gotten you to the other shore. In the same way, gathas like that help bring us deeper with it. When we are there, we no longer need those kind of images, right? Because we begin to experience, like you're saying, a sense of inwardness, a sense of groundedness, right? A sense of peace. What is that? That is our unborn Buddha mind, which we all have the seed of. Right? I mean, if you say, well, how is it that I can experience peace of mind? This sense of stability, this sense of groundedness, and that doesn't depend on anything, right? It's just here. Once I touch it, well, that's because that is our minds, right? That is our Buddha seat. In the refuge, in the ceremony of taking refuge that Thich Nhat Hanh wrote. He says, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are present in every corner of the universe. I don't know if you remember that phrase. Because you're present in every corner of the universe. And when you know that, then you're never lost, and you're never alone. Because you know wherever you are, all these forces inherent in your mind and being are always available to you. Right? But to experience that, we need all kinds of practices, and words, and metaphors, and examples, and similes. Right? They are all good teachings take us to the same place. There's only one place, right, in truth, and that's right here. And we keep thinking that there's a places we want to get to, right? But we only think there's places we want to get to because we somehow think where we are, this can't be the place. right? Because somehow we think it couldn't possibly be here, right? But that's not true. You know, going back to the Buddha himself, the Buddha awoke. He had his great enlightenment that he became the Buddha. You know, and everything, all his teachings and everything came from that experience. He had it in his body, right? By a river under a tree in India. I mean, it wasn't extraordinary, right? He wasn't transported to mystical realms, right? He woke up within his own body mind. We need to remember that. There's no place to go to. There's nothing we really have to get out of. I mean, our challenge for each of us is to awaken right now. To what? To what's right here. But because we're always seeking, it's somewhere else, and always believing that somehow it's got to be something else than this. It's really because we have not really paid attention to the Buddha's teachings. Because all the teachers for 2,500 years from the Buddha until now say the same thing, right? It's all right here. Right. When you listen to Zen Master Bunke, he was kind of an extraordinary type of being. We know that his teaching, which was so simple and so direct, if you remember, for those who were at the retreat, if those weren't, he said when he had his enlightenment experience, I mean, he had been practicing for 10 years in the most arduous way. You know, he was such a bullheaded, stubborn kind of guy. You know, he just thought he could just push his way, fight his way, struggle his way. I mean, he lived in caves. He wouldn't eat for weeks. He would, you know, just the most difficult practices. He was unremitting, right? And he nearly killed himself, you know, with that kind of practice. And when finally the whole thing just opened up for him and it all fell away, he was just kind of amazed, right? That it was all right here. Right. And all his so-called hard work really hadn't gotten him anywhere. And it was really when he finally let go. What did he let go of? Everything. Some people have to get to a place of darkness and desperation before they let go. But you don't have to. But if you want to, you can. Again, it's like, you know, in the alcohol addiction field, right? You know, some people realize they get a problem with drinking or drugs early on, right? And they stop. Most people do that, don't they, who experiment. But people who get addicted, some people can't stop, don't stop, right? And they don't stop until when? There's an expression that says when they hit bottom, right? I'm sure you've heard that expression, right? You know, where is bottom? You know. No one knows where bottom is until they hit it, right? If you've ever been involved with a drug addict or alcoholic or worked in that field, you know when you see how screwed up and messy and their lives become, you'd think, oh, this must be bottom. You know, this must, you know, the message must, you know, should be gotten by now. Nope. Continue on. Some people need it to be very dark before they can turn toward the light. Right? But other people get it earlier on. You know, there's an expression in Zen that says, they compare it to riding a horse. And they say the well-trained horse, the rider only has to lift the, the crop, you know, or whatever it is they hold in their hand. It only has to lift, the horse only has to see the shadow of the crop, and off it goes. But the untrained horse, you know, you have to kind of beat it before it takes off. I know that's not the nicest kind of Buddhist, forgive me, I mean, I do love animals, but but anyhow, it obviously comes from a time when horsemen kind of ruled the roost. But again, it's sort of like that. You know, some of us, we kind of get it earlier on, right? We don't need a lot of pain and suffering to realize there's a better way to live, right? But some of us just need an incredible amount of pain and suffering before we begin to contemplate turning our life in a new direction. Who's to say, right? Other than everyone is different. Any other questions about practice before we... Good. Actually, you know, I was going to get back. I will get back into the Bodhisattva way, but Salima reminded me last couple of months we were working from the slogans from the Great Path of Awakening, and there's a phrase when you talk about the island in myself, eternally. There's a phrase in the slogan that says, "Do not depend on external circumstances or external conditions." I think that's a great slogan. Do not depend on external conditions, right? Unfortunately, many of us who do not have an island in themselves, and again, an island in themselves in the way that Thich Nhat Hanh refers, it means you know, if you think about the ocean, right, and waves, when you're in the ocean, adrift, right, and there are always waves, right, pushing you this way and pushing you that way, when you spot an island, right, you are very happy, even if it's a little island, right, that you have somewhere solid and stable to stand on, right, a place that you can rest, a place where you can have some stability, and that you can look around you and kind of see, you know, like those cartoons, you know, maybe a little island with a nice tall palm tree, right, that you can climb up to the top, and at least you can kind of look around and see where you are, right? See, most people don't have that, do they? Most people are just always being tossed about by life, their own internal life, their own thoughts, their own feelings, their own stuff, their past, their issues, their neuroses, their, you know what I mean? Their reactive formations. I mean, most people are, if they're not being tossed around by their internal stuff, right? They're constantly tossed around by the external stuff. What's going on in the world? What's this one doing and that one's doing? Who likes me? Who doesn't like me? How successful am I? You know what I mean? My goals. So most people are just always tossed about in life, right? Like this person who's been adrift is just tossed about by the waves, right? When the waves recede or lessen, it's you know, maybe can float a bit, more comfortable, right? But then the winds pick up and the waves come back, and before you know it, you're just struggling to, you know, to stay alive, stay afloat. Maybe when it's calmer, you can swim a little bit in the direction you want, but as soon as the waves get a little higher, once again you're pushed this way and that, right? And that's the way most people live their life. How wonderful then to have an island, right? If you could imagine that's what you've been dealing with for weeks or months, right? How wonderful to have a place that you can stand on, rest on, right? Climb the tree and look around and see where you are and where you want to go. So, how good it is, right? Through the practice of mindfulness, through the practice of concentration, through the practice of insight, and through the practices of developing some core values, right? Core sense of who you are and what your life's about and what you want it to be and how you want to be in the world. You know, now you have, especially if that's buttressed by a meditative practice that can ground you, you know, now you have the basis for not being tossed about by life and by situations, by the ups and downs and the back and forth of life. And as it says here in the verse, you know, as long as we are dependent on external conditions, we can only be tossed about, right? Because when things go well, we will be elated. And when things take a turn in the other way, we will be downcast, right? And they'll just be up and down and back and forth and feeling good and feeling bad and feeling happy, feeling unhappy and feeling successful and feeling unsuccessful and feeling worthy and feeling unworthy and feeling valued and feeling unvalued and, you know, do I need to go on?
No.
You know the list, right? And that's the way most of us live our lives, right? And again, it's conditioned on what? It's conditioned on how the external world is going, right? And on our own stuff that's coming up from inside. And so again, it's like being tossed about, right? But again, through the practice of mindfulness, through the practice of concentration, through the practice of insight, through developing understanding and wisdom and cultivating intelligence, etc., etc., one has an island to ground one. And it doesn't mean that external conditions don't cease to exist, right? There's still success, there's still failure, there's still people who like us and people who don't like us. Sometimes things go well and sometimes things don't go well, and sometimes we're healthy and sometimes we're not healthy, and sometimes we're full of energy and sometimes we have no energy, right? That'll continue. That's just life, isn't it? But our happiness, our well-being, our sense of stability and groundedness will no longer be dependent on external conditions. If you're dependent on external conditions, your stability is very fragile. No wonder people have a lot of anxiety and worry. Because they feel that their life condition is dependent on how things turn out. You see, so that can cause one to worry, to be anxious, to be scared, to lose sleep. But if one knows that deeply, that one's condition in life is not necessarily conditioned by external circumstances, then one can be in the world of up and down and back and forth and success and failure and be much more at ease. Anybody want to stand up for anxiety and worry? No, I'm serious. I remember once years and years ago when I was a psychotherapist, I once had actually a well-established therapist who came to me for some specific kind of habit or some kind of behavioral pattern they wanted to work on. And when I was getting to know them early on, they mentioned about they had this kind of, always have had in their life, this kind of low-level anxiety, you know, that was always present. So I said to her, well, would you like to be free of it, get rid of it? And she looked at me as if I had said the most bizarre thing. I mean, it was quite astounding to me. I mean, she looked at me because it obviously, it had been with her so long that she really, the idea of not having it was just unbelievable to her. I mean, not even unbelievable, but she had never even thought of living without it. I mean, she was just so accepting that having chronic low-level anxiety, you know, didn't interfere with her life that much, as the kind of background hum of her life was absolutely normal. So I don't know why that came into mind, but I mean, I guess we do live with all kinds of things, whether it's on the worry-anxiety side or on the despair-depression-sadness-melancholy side, or on the anger, resentment, frustration side. I mean, we have all kinds of ways of being in the world that we think, that we just identify as us. Right? Never seeing that that's not true. Very few children come into this world as infants with anxiety disorders. Infants don't bear resentments, do they? And even if infants are sad because their needs aren't being met, as soon as the needs are met, they smile. So please remember that much of what we accept as normal in our emotional makeup may not be. It may have been caused by causes and conditions. We may not remember a time before. But if you're just around infants and young children enough, or remember your own, you will see that nobody is born this way. Causes and conditions create the growth of these types of emotional patterns. I mean, do you believe that, or maybe you don't? I mean, yes.
So what did you say to this lady with the hum of anxiety?
I basically said sort of what I'm saying to you. I mean, it wasn't a Buddhist context. It was a more professional context. But I did say, you know, we could definitely work on it. And there's no reason for her to live her life with chronic low-level anxiety, even though she's very functional and, you know, has a good profession, and has a family, you know what I mean, the whole deal. Now, the question is, did she enter treatment for that? I don't remember. I mean, I could make up a happy ending. But I am sure the offer was made, because I remember very clearly her reaction.
And how does this help with that, potentially?
How does, what is the this and the that? Again, I mean, it's not simply that mindfulness, you know. But mindfulness is the gateway. Because mindfulness gives us the capacity to see what's going on. To see clearly when an emotion is present in us and when an emotion is not present in us. It lets us clearly see what thoughts are arising in our mind. Because we practice not only mindfulness of walking and sitting and breathing, we also practice mindfulness of physical sensations, we practice mindfulness of thought, we practice mindfulness of feeling, we practice awareness of the mind. To have an objective awareness of one's mind life, right? Physical, emotional, mental, means that one now has the capability of seeing what before one could not see. One could only be swept away by. One could only react to. Right? Mindfulness means that I can now see what's arising within me, right? For example, I'm aware there's anxiety in me, right? Which is a different stance than being swept away by anxiety. Right? Now you have an island that you're stepping on, that you're standing on. You have objectivity. To say anything such as, I'm aware there's worry in me, I'm aware there's anxiety in me, I'm aware there's sadness in me, I'm aware there's anger in me, I'm aware there's impatience in me, I'm aware there's frustration in me, you know, all the kinds of emotional things that usually take us over, right? And cause us to react in very traditional ways in terms of our thinking, in terms of the way we, what we might say or how we might act out, right? Mindfulness allows us to, when you hold thoughts and emotions and mindfulness, you now have space and objectivity to do what? To respond appropriately rather than react habitually. Okay? So developing mindfulness, self-awareness, gives us the possibility of very simply working our way out of these emotional patterns, because we see simply that's all they are. In the same way, we were saying earlier, you're practicing awareness of the breath, right? You're practicing mindfulness of breath. Thoughts arise. Learning that I, just because a thought about the past, the future, a drama, you know, whatever you want to say, arises in my mind does not mean I have to what? Follow it. Most people do not know that, do they? Right? Most people, you know, the dramas that arise in their life, which means they arise in their mind, and that they obsess and consume and replay and, you know, and then bring up all kinds of emotionality and then act out, they think what? They have to do it, don't they? They have to play it out. Even though, you know, when you're more rational, and if, you know, if somebody said, you know, if you play this out, where is it going to go? Right? And objectively, you would say what? Not in a good place. Right? I've been down this road before. Whether it's a pattern of thought and reactivity within yourself, whether it's a way of interacting with colleagues or significant others, spouses, children, parents, you know, most people, if they have some self-awareness and you ask them, you know, if you keep on this, if you keep playing this out, where is it going to go? They'll say what? Good place? Mm-mm-mm. Right, Brian? Right. Not a good place. But if we don't have self-awareness, if we don't have mindfulness, we're just constantly forced to what? Replay, 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 even though the same suffering occurs. Right? Because we don't have the tools to do it differently. Buddha Dharma gives us the tools. It tells us there is another way, and then it gives us the tools and how to do that. And that's important. So mindfulness to me is you know, like a basic tool for mental health. You know. I mean, without mindfulness, it is very hard to get anywhere in terms of having a healthy mind. Because without some kind of self-awareness, some capacity to objectively view the workings of one's own mind and emotions, how can you change it? Right? So, kind of mindfulness is a foundation for, I would say, having a healthy mind. And then in terms of Buddhist practice and meditative practice, one can go deeper and deeper and deeper. But mindfulness is the ground. Mindfulness is the island that I return to. Is that clear, Salima? Mindfulness is the island. Because when I have mindfulness, right, I have the capacity of seeing clearly what's going on. And when I can see clearly what's going on, name it, not get involved in it, not follow it, see it, you know, because I understand what it's about, now I have an island here. Right? That allows, you know, when I'm on that island, it's got a nice hill, right? Let's say 15-foot high hill. Right? They can still be 10-foot waves, can't they? Right? But I'm not in the water anymore. Big difference. Big difference. Right? You know, if I have an island and it's only got a, it's only 2 feet above sea level, I'm only good for what? Calm days. Many of us are like that, right? Our stability, our mindfulness, our groundedness is just a few feet high. We do okay with 2 foot waves, 3 foot waves, but when the 5 foot waves come, we're off. We're off again. So that's why we want to, you know, over time, extend the island, strengthen the island, make it bigger. So eventually, it's big enough and tall enough that the waves of life can come and go. We're not trying to stop the waves. We're just trying to stop our being thrown about, tossed about by them. Again, those are the emotional waves of our own creation, and those are the waves of life. Is everybody kind of thinking about their own life? What are you thinking? Do you think it's possible to create an island? Anybody think it's no? All you can do is just be tossed about by the waves and, you know, get an inner tube. That's what most people do. Get an inner tube or get some kind of scuba outfit, right? Something they can inhale. Time limited. So in the beginning, the gathas, they help us create an island. Small island, but one that I can rest on. But over time, you want it to be a very portable island, one that always is with you. It's not dependent. Many of us, our peace of mind, our calmness is dependent on place or situation, right? Cushion. But over time, we want to be grounded enough within ourself, within our own body mind, that anywhere we go, it goes with us, or we are it, so to say. Yes, Gary.
That there are times that when I get in my fear or my discontent or my what's happening, it's a case of mistaken identity. I think that's the island.
That's the.
I think that's the island. I get sort of cling to those old familiar negative patterns.
Yeah.
And I hold on to it because I somehow. There's another conditioning, like, that's familiar, that's the island.
Right. But what kind of island is it?
Well, I haven't gotten there yet.
No, but I mean, you know, like in Salima's, you see the transition. What Thich Nhat Hanh's saying is, look, you know, let's create an island that's beautiful, right? There are trees, there are fresh breezes, there are streams. See, developmentally, you know, if you're talking about that habitual negative island, right? It's not a beautiful place. It's not a peaceful place, is it? So it's probably good to turn that in for a nicer island, an island that you can be happier on, right?
Trade in.
But then over time, you don't want to need that anymore because you're still constricted. You have to be on the island. But I mean, again, it's. But see, this is why, again, you know, you can't kind of separate it all out, you know, these various teachings and practices, because, you know, in a certain sense, what we're talking about goes back to the Buddha's enlightenment, you know, his own experience of his own Buddha nature, his own true nature, where he has this experience where he realizes, you know, our, you know, the mind of everyone, the nature of everyone's mind is perfect, right? Lacks nothing, totally complete, right? And in this, there's total, absolute happiness and freedom. So, I mean, from the Buddha on, that, you know, I'm speaking now from a kind of a more psychological, right? You know, what is a healthy human being? We could say, if we want to kind of demystify Buddhism, you know, we can say, what is a Buddha? A totally healthy human being, right? All the positive qualities, aspects of his mind, of mind, his, her mind, is totally manifest, right? That's a Buddha. A totally healthy human being. Right? So now we have a model. Right? See, the model for many of us in the West is what? Somebody with good coping skills. Right? Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, basically in our society, you know, if you are free of major pathology, right? You're not clinically depressed, you're not clinically suffering from an anxiety disorder, you don't have any kind of major, you know, mental illness or emotional illness, right? And you have good coping skills, then you're considered what? Well, a mentally healthy person in our society. The Buddhist psychology has a totally different model of what a mentally healthy person is. I mean, what I just described wouldn't even get above negative. it's not at zero yet. Forget about going into the positive realm. Right? It sounds strange, doesn't it? I understand I may be saying things that sound strange to people. But in Buddhist psychology, it is the absence, complete absence of negative mental and emotional factors. But even more importantly, it is the presence of all kinds of positive ones. Right? Calmness, peace of mind, open-heartedness, loving-kindness, compassion, patience. You know what I mean? All these positive qualities, energetic, clarity. Right? So when you look at Buddhist psychology and you can take a look at it, it enumerates positive mind states that a healthy person who practices this path is cultivating. And the absence of anger and frustration and fear and doubt and frustration and, right, despair and, right, absence. No longer present. That's a healthy human being. And that all these positive qualities. So, so for those of you who are interested, I invite you to acquaint yourself a little more with the Buddhist psychology. It is a psychology that is 2,500 years old. Western psychology goes back what? 100 years? More or less? Buddhist psychology goes back 2,500 years, and it's an experimental psychology. People have been experimenting, not reading about, experimenting themselves. Different historical epochs, different cultures, different countries, all different types of people, and yet the results are always replicated. It's a scientific model. Good replication across all kinds of norms. That's why it's good to practice the path, Gary, right? To study the teachings, because I'm just sharing a little bit today, but that gives you a model, like you say, of, wow. You know, again, like that woman who I'm talking about who goes, I'm a functional neurotic, right? That's better than a lot of people, right? Who are dysfunctional neurotics, right? I'm a functional neurotic. And when all of a sudden she was told, but you can be free of neuroses, it was like, what are you talking about? Right? I thought I was doing pretty good. Do you understand, Gary? So it's a different model of mental health that we're not, right? We don't really understand. Right? And then so now we have a different model, which means we have a mirror now to look at ourselves and go, right? Oh, things that I just thought I was stuck with, or things that I thought were me, are really not. Really? They just develop because of causes and conditions, and I can change the causes and conditions and using the technology of meditation and mindfulness and concentration, and I can change significantly. And that, again, a lot of these things that we think are normal, fears and anxieties and worries and depressions and angers and resentments and frustrations and issues, right? We all think we have to have what? Issues. Right? We get together and we talk about what? Our issues. First I tell you my issues, then you tell me your issues. Why don't we? And this is the way we kind of relate to each other.
So we get together and talk about our positives.
Well, we get together and just enjoy being with each other and living life together. It doesn't have to be so issue-driven. No, but obviously, I mean, again, I'm being a little, maybe I'm being a little, what am I being a little? I don't mean to be dismissive of our issues. And I understand that for many of us, our issues seem very real, right? And they seem very overwhelming. And we identify ourselves very much with them. I am my issues. And that's where we start. I guess now speaking more seriously, and I have been speaking seriously, it is important, even though it may be a little painful for us to hear that, that we do not need our issues. And that we can live quite happily without them. And that our issues are based on a identification with a narrative of self. Which is just a story. And because we keep repeating it over and over again, day after day, from the moment we get up to the moment we go to bed, we've all become true believers. in our narrative of self, and our story, and our issues, and it's hard for us to believe that one can be free of it. But that is, at the deeper levels, what this practice is about. It's about freedom. So for me not to say that, I would be delinquent or deleterious in my role as a teacher of Dharma. Not to say that that is what this is really about. Doesn't mean tomorrow we're all going to wake up free. Doesn't mean there's not work to be done, right? But please understand, this work is about freedom. You know, when you hear words freedom, liberation, it means just that. Liberation from that which constricts us. Liberation from that which from which we cause our own suffering. Right? Mental suffering, emotional suffering. So the Buddha's teaching is about freedom, liberation from suffering. Especially the self-induced suffering. I mean, does that make sense to people? Maybe it doesn't. I mean, if that's not clear to you, please ask me a question. I mean, if you don't understand it or how to do it or what this is about or disagree, please feel free to say whatever's in your heart mind. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I wouldn't be here if I was happy with low-level anxiety and depression. I'm obviously trying to build an island, and it feels about as big as this cushion right now. So hoping to maybe make it a little bit like that.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Then like that.
Right. Know. Right. But again, it's important early on, right? To have that kind of intention, and to know it's possible—that's a big deal, right? I mean, I'm not. I mean, that's really the key point. I know because Chris is fairly new, right, to this path. So it's important early on in the practice to have that very, you know, clear intention, and to know that it's realizable, right? And to know that as long as you keep at it, right, you will go from a little cushion to a bigger cushion. You know, and the same way, you know, if I said to you, you know, when you leave here tonight, if you want to go to St. Pete, all you need to do is go up Kennedy, make a left, get on the, right, go across the Gant. You know, I mean, and as long as you follow directions, you will end up where? St. Pete. Guaranteed. So it's important, but if you don't have that intention, and if you don't have that belief in the directions, then who knows? You know, you may set out 5 minutes. You might go, I'm not sure if that's really if I really want to go there, right? Or that, you know, that guy that gave me the directions. I'm not even sure he knew what he was talking about. Right? You know what I'm saying? Or we'll before you know it, we'll be off. You know, getting on the Dale Mabry or something, I don't know, going somewhere, you see, but if you know where you want to go, and you have a clear intention of getting there, and you trust the map, then it's kind of easy, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't mean you don't have to drive, right, and pay attention, but at least it'll go where you want. But if you don't have that intention, and if you don't believe that the goal is realizable, and, you know, don't believe the direction or the person giving the directions, then who knows what'll happen. What are you thinking, Twee? I'm just picking on all the new people. I mean, does it make sense to you? What? Can you speak up a little bit?
I was thinking about what you said about external conditions.
Uh-huh.
And the idea of attaining the meditative state of mind. I was thinking about what I do. And when I get into my creative mode, you know, because I'm a designer.
Get into your creative mode.
Think that I reach that meditative state. Nothing matters. So is that okay? I mean, is it one way of defining meditation?
Yeah, I mean, again, there are different kinds of meditation, so please understand, all right? And there are different purposes in Buddhist meditation. But what you're talking about is a state that is present in all meditation, no matter what you're doing, which is that place of absorption, we might call that, right? Right. And so no matter what your meditative practice is, you want to have that state of absorption, which is means... you are totally 100% involved. And like you say, when you experience that, right, it's very energetic, right? It's very peaceful. There's a kind of happiness or a serenity. I mean, you can see, you don't have to create those states, do you? They're the outcome of that absorption. In meditation, it's called meditative absorption, sometimes called samadhi. Right, and it's the same thing. But what you want to do is learn, you know, and people, you know, musicians talk about that. A lot of artists, creative people talk about getting in that place. The runners talk about the zone. You know what I mean. The runner's high, or I mean, you know what I'm saying. Athletes talk about that. I remember once I worked with a man. He was a golf pro, and he basically said, all his life as a golf pro, he was always working at his stroke. But the best game he ever had was when none of that happened. And he doesn't know what happened. But all his planning and analysis and, you know, all disappeared. And he just played. Right? He didn't think about anything. It just happened. And he said it was the best game he ever played in his life. And it was the happiest game he ever played. So again, if you're asking me, does that absorptive, meditative state exist in life? Of course it does. Right? And many of us, you know, have touched it briefly in these kinds of situations that I talk about. Right? Unfortunately, those are very specific to a certain type of situation. What you want to do in this practice is learn to be like that in every situation. Totally present, totally absorbed, not distracted, not thinking of past and future, you know. So one can have that kind of equanimity and peace of mind and inner joy and ease no matter what one's doing. Is that clear? Yeah.
Is that
speak up, I'm having trouble. Well, if you say to me, I only experience that when I'm just doing this certain thing, then I would say, yes, it is dependent on... the same way if somebody said to me, you know, when I'm sitting on my cushion on my meditation, I can have deep peacefulness and calm and ease. But as soon as I get off my cushion... You know, then I'd say, yeah, I mean, you know, you're being, your happiness and well-being is conditioned on a certain specific type of state. So, you know, that is why if you read the sayings of the old Zen masters, Chinese masters or whatever, you see they would often, castigate meditators who spend all their time sitting on a cushion meditating. So that's not Zen, right? You know, that's for idiots. You know, but why do they say that? Because they're trying to, because they can see that someone is just achieving a meditative state based on sitting on a cushion or being in a certain environment, like being in a meditation hall or being in a temple or being on retreat. You know, the true practice is you have this well-being and calmness, insight, understanding wherever you go. Right? Yeah. But it's, but again, you know, it's good to have these little islands. Because then you got a place to work out from, right? You know, you've had an experience, you know, whether it's in music or, you know, a lot of people have that in nature, right? On top of a mountain, you know what I mean? You just, all of a sudden, everything just drops away and everything is simple and you don't have all your games and your tools and your this, but you feel very happy, right? Oh, I don't need anything to be happy, right? Like that. But unfortunately, we don't stay there, do we? We get back into what? Our drama. What?
Floating on our raft.
Floating on our raft. Or carrying our raft. It weighs us down. Yeah. Good. Any questions? It's about 8:30. So any final comments? Yes.
Along the same line. Last question. You know, lately I've been getting involved with a lot of projects, like around my house with gardening or different things. And when I do that, I can get very creative and very focused as well.
Yeah.
For instance, today I was building a greenhouse. And, you know, I'm completely focused on the project.
Good.
But I don't feel serene when I'm doing that. And I definitely don't feel like I'm bringing mindfulness into the situation. I just, you know, just feel completely like just working on this. Just and then when I'm done.
Yeah, but so can everybody hear Brian? So he's saying he does a lot of projects around the house. He was building a greenhouse today, very focused, nothing else in his mind, very focused, but he wasn't peaceful and serene. How were you?
A little tense.
Tense. Yeah, so you got to learn to relax.
So I guess that's my question.
Yeah, learn to enjoy life.
I got to bring, you know, find a way to bring mindfulness even when I'm that focused.
No. You got to learn, no. Okay, I'll show you one thing.
Okay.
Now, I'm very focused on you. Okay. You see that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm nothing else. I'm focused all on you. Okay. I'm very focused on you. Right? Okay. Which one would you rather be? How do you want to do it?
Second way. The easy way.
So relax. You know, in Buddhism, we'll end. Joyful effort. Right. Thank you.